From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with the author Stephen Wingate, whose works include the new novel Of Fathers and Fire, published by the University of Nebraska Press as part of its Flyover Fiction series, the digital memoir Daddy Labyrinth, which premiered at the Singapore Art Science Museum in 2014, and the short story collection Wife Shopping, which won the Bakeless Prize from the Breadloaf Writers Conference and was published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt in 2008. Stephen Wingate is an associate professor at South Dakota State University and associate editor at Fiction Writers Review. Here's a little information about Of Fathers and Fire. When Richie Thorpe and his ragtag religious band of ex-thieves arrive in the High Plains town of Suburney, Colorado, Tommy Sander is captivated by the group. It's the summer of 1980 in the dusty junkyard town, and the 17-year-old is wrestling with the forces shaping America and himself. The Iran hostage crisis, the incoming tide of Ronald Reagan's presidency, and the political rise of the Christian right. As Tommy is increasingly drawn to the group, his mother, Connie, grows frantic. She has been hiding the truth from her son, telling him that his father was a saxophonist from New York who never knew he had a child, and is lying low in Suburney to hide from Tommy's actual father, Richie Thorpe. Connie knows Richie has come for his son, and though she has witnessed Thorpe's mysterious powers, the desperation to protect her lie, her son, and their life begets a venom with an elemental power that threatens the whole town. Of Fathers and Fire captures America when the radical expressiveness of the 1970s butted up against the polarizing backlash that we still see at work in America today. It is an important and riveting contribution to the psychic map of the recent past that brought us to our present. When I read Of Fathers and Fire, I was struck by the way in which it's a real mix of narrative and idea, of one character's story within a novel of larger issues. And so I asked Stephen Wingate how the book started for him. Was it with place, with character, with personal questions, or with the larger ideas, politics, religion, fatherhood? Our conversation includes a train running through the South Dakota countryside behind Stephen's thoughts on craft. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
In some ways, it's really a Bildungsroman. It's the coming of age story. It's about a place where I was living when I was about the age of my protagonist. So there's that whole element, which is, I think, really clear and on the surface. But I also wanted to write a book about America, because I think about America a lot, especially now when America really needs to be thought about. And I wanted to write a book about what I saw in the country in 1980, that this whole movement, which is kind of having a version 2.0 right now, very deeply affected by a very narrow interpretation of Christianity that I saw as a teenager when I was in Colorado, and strangely seeing now again.
The book takes place in a single month, in July 1980. I thought that was an interesting way to time it, and it's the Iran hostage crisis. Jimmy Carter is president, and Ronald Reagan is campaigning. It felt so relevant to the present day as I read, and made me think again about how we have not just learned how to hate one another, you know, that we've known how to do that for a while, haven't we?
Yes.
Yeah. But on the other hand, there are other time periods that would have also reflected that. And so is this based in part because that's the time period when you were growing up there?
Yeah, that intersection between the what you're talking about with the big ideas and the Bildungsroman, that was the place, the intersection where I really wanted to write this book.
Okay. And how about Tommy? Does he remind you of yourself, or did he kind of become his own character as you worked, starting with?
He's definitely his own character. Yeah. I mean, we shared some aspects for sure, but he is definitely a more angry person than I was. I was a pretty angry teenage kid, but Tommy is off the charts. He's got just a lot more venom to him than I ever did, and he's just a more troubled character.
And he has so many questions, you know, and I sort of enjoyed that aspect of his personality, because by virtue of having so many questions, as readers, we get a lot of answers ultimately, or at least we get to ruminate with him about his life and his questions. So at the opening of the novel, his mom has told him a story about who his father is, sort of just to kind of get him to stop asking, I think. I loved how his inner world is so rich. He's always imagining what might be, imagining himself in other situations. He kind of talks to houses and inanimate objects and flips off cars and Reagan banners. And I liked that sort of juxtaposed with all of his questioning. So I wondered if you could talk about this aspect of his character. And also, I was curious if you ever had to pull back from his interior musings just to kind of get back to reality as you wrote.
And short answer to the second question, yes. I had to pull back from just thinking about what was going on inside of Tommy's mind, or else I wouldn't have had a narrative. That's, I think, the tension of almost any work of fiction that's going to be dealing with the interior mind. How much do you go with that mind? How much do you have to root that person in the world? And for me, I wanted to have a narrative that was going to move forward, that was going to have a sense of pace for the reader and not simply get lost in the interiority. I think there are some wonderful books that are extremely interior, but that wasn't this one. In terms of that first question, the sense of place and isolation are really what I think shapes Tommy's mind and psyche. He's living in a town of 43 people, and there's nobody his age. They're just not much around for him. So he is finding most of his testing that goes on in the world, the way young people are testing themselves against the world all the time, that's happening in an imaginative way for him, because there's just not that much for him to test himself against. So he invents a father in New York. His mom tells him, your dad was a wandering sax player from New York City who loved me and left me and doesn't even know that you exist. And so Tommy creates an entire persona for himself based on his dad being a sax player, and he finds an old sax and he plays it even though it's broken, and this becomes the core of his personality and what he wants to be. And it's sort of sad that this is actually a lie,
right? Yeah. Which comes to kind of I won't go there right now. I enjoyed his wandering around with his horn and playing it. That was just wonderful. But you know, reading this book made me think about something that's going to sound kind of obvious, but I hadn't thought a lot about it before. But I just read Delia Owen's book, Where the Crawdads Sing, which is like this very different novel, but it also grapples with children's sort of searching for parents. And reading of Fathers and Fire made me think about the nature of things, which is that if a mother is not around, at least her story is known. Everybody knows who she was before she left, right? But a missing father is like a totally blank canvas. And that makes for a very different kind of story. Were you particularly drawn to the whole idea of fathers and sons as you started this book? Was that a natural place to go from the narrative that you wanted to tie into the larger ideas?
Yes, absolutely. I lost my dad when I was 10, and my life since then has just been all about fatherlessness, and that's been a big theme in my work. This is the novel that really deals with it most, but fatherlessness has been a major defining thing for me. I remember being Tommy's age and just wondering, well, who the heck am I? And one time when I was in college, I had a friend who said, Steve, you're so lucky, you know, you can make your father into anything in the world that you want. I know exactly who my dad is. And I don't think he got it. Yeah. not knowing who your father is, it leaves you in a little bit, I mean, as a young man, and I can't speak for a young woman, but certainly for me as a young man and many other young men I've seen in this situation, there's just too much choice and not enough rootedness.
Right.
And that's, I think, where Tommy is at. He has too many Tommies, because he has too many, he doesn't know who his dad is. He doesn't have that rootedness and that sense of, well, this is how the men in my family open their cans of beer or hang up their clothes. These are the kinds of things that, especially now that I'm a dad myself, I see young minds being shaped simply by having that access to the father. So fatherlessness for me is really one of the big issues. I actually am hoping to move away from it as a writer, because I think I've maybe done it and need to move on to other fixations.
But we do have fixations in writing, and I think sometimes they come back without being intentional, don't you think?
Totally.
Yeah. All right, so we already mentioned that the book sort of seems to have a couple of main focus. Well, I don't know if I can equate them necessarily, but the politics of the way that religion has been used within society in a time that changed America, 1980, and then the story of this one young man in a small Colorado town. And I wondered, as you were working, what was, if this is a question that can be answered, what was the priority for you when you were depicting Tommy's story? Was his story, did that tend to take precedence, or was the larger universe or more political story always top of mind?
I think that his story is the thing that really I needed to tell. And as time went on and I worked with him more, I wanted to explore more of his world, to shine a light on what was happening around him, rather than simply working with that interiority. So I started with that interiority, and I think gradually over the course of the writing, moved away from it and focused more and more on the world. This is a novel that I first started writing a long time ago, 2005 or 6, and I tend to take a really long time to write things, something I'd also like to change about myself. But what happens is that I would write this novel, and I would put it away, and I would write it, and I would put it away. And then 2016 came around, and I said, wow, we're really going back to the future here. I need to pick this novel up again. And when I did, I moved some of that 1980s religious politics up front, a little up closer to the front. I don't know if I would have been able to do that if I had simply tried to publish the novel a few years earlier. It would have been a different book. It would not have had that engagement.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing you say that you take a long time to write a novel, because I would have actually guessed that. And because I feel like sometimes when I read a novel, I just feel like it is so round and full and rich and full of, I mean, there's just so much here. It couldn't have been done quickly. It had to have been done very, with a wandering journey in a way. I almost feel like you had to make some mistakes and then back up to figure out where you were going. I can't explain it very well, but that's...
I think you're explaining it really well. To me, that's part of the fun, is to keep going back into a work and pulling new things out of it over and over again. I think that does give a depth to it.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I'm just going to focus on the story, or I'm just going to focus on the interior moment of my character. You get a lot more interplay when you take more time.
Yeah. The one thing that I think I would guess about your work, though, is that you're willing to throw things out when it's not going. I mean, I think one thing that is a mistake for people who take forever to write is that they hang on to everything and then it never comes together. And I don't get that sense from your work. I don't know.
I'm a chucker. I actually save old things in boxes, but I lose my emotional connection to them and just say, all right, we're ready to go. So sometimes I have students, especially grad students, who think, hey, I want to do writing for my career. I say, all right, well, you need to be willing to write 350 pages and then just chuck it. And they give me funny looks, but I think that you have to be able to. You don't always get it right the first time. In fact, you rarely do.
Yeah.
And if sometimes you can just give yourself a clean break and you give yourself a change in perspective, sometimes, you know, 1 or 2% change in what your narrator knows about the world that you're depicting is an enormous tool. It can make an enormous change to the voice of the book. So leaving myself open to that kind of change is a wonderful thing. And it happens not on a global scale only. Of course, it happens on a global scale, but it also can happen on an individual scene. So if I'm going back into an individual scene and saying, I'm going to create a narrator here. I'm going to let my narrator know more about what's going on, why these people don't like each other or do like each other. And so on the micro level, going in there with that change of perspective can add richness to a scene.
Yeah. You've already mentioned, and we both kind of mentioned, that there's religious themes running through this book. And I really liked the fact that Tommy uses the word Jesus throughout the novel as an almost catch-all phrase for what he's looking for and doesn't know or understand fully yet. The word took on sort of meanings other than just the figure of Jesus. And I wondered what that meant to you as the author, as you were working. What were you hoping to invoke for Tommy or for us as you used the word Jesus in this way?
Well, Tommy, as a kid, he's really kind of a young mystic. He's very interested in a vision of God that is really inclusive, that in which all the world, all creation is one. And that's not something that he really found in his life. His mom's an atheist. The people around him are kind of punitive fundamentalists. And I completely agree with what you said about the use of Jesus. It's really a catch-all. He doesn't really know yet what it is his religious feelings are all about. He has them. They're sincere. They're actually, to me, they seem really profound. But he's living in a world where he has almost no frame of reference for the kinds of religious experience that he is having and desiring. In his world, that the whole idea of mysticism and of union with God is just, it doesn't exist. It's like you follow the rules, you do what you're told, and then you're right with God. And it's a very strange encounter that I had with that branch of Christianity when I first moved to Colorado when I was 13. I grew up in North Jersey, and it was I didn't know what Protestants were. I didn't know what fundamentalists were. And then suddenly I was among them, and they were telling me that I was going to hell for worshiping statues because I was Catholic, still am. And that, that clash between perspectives of religion, to me, it's both microcosm and macrocosm. Within Tommy's world and his interiority, he is experiencing a clash between those two things because he wants the mysticism, but he's surrounded by the punitive Christianity. And America, at the same time, was going through some big challenges in Christianity. There was the rise of the religious right, and at the same time, the kind of the last of the Jesus freaks from the 60s and 70s were kind of dying out. Mm-hmm. So Tommy's got a little bit of that Jesus freak nature in him. There's that microcosm of him and the macrocosm of what's happening with American Christianity. And I definitely wanted to take that on as well.
And it's also like this other missing father figure in a way, isn't it? It sort of reflects that aspect of the book too.
Totally.
Yeah. Do you mind if I read a paragraph that I particularly liked and then we can talk about it?
Sure.
Okay. This is from very early in the book, and I'll just read it. Tommy, the fatherless boy, they pitied and loved and fed sometimes until he started playing that awful broken saxophone, until he started calling his mom a slut, then tried making a slut out of every girl he got his hands on, until those took the hostages and Tommy said he'd never serve his country, that he'd rather burn himself alive in an American flag than get shipped off to die in Iran. Before that, they were willing to put up with his bullshit even after he quit football, but his disrespecting the flag was inexcusable. Now that he was almost 18, their pity had hardened into an unacknowledged species of hate, the kind one holds for a national traitor, and they counted the months until Tommy left town. If the new batch of Jesus freaks took him, fine. If Dan Stannard married his mom and he ran away screaming, fine. When the good citizens of Suburnia heard the cowbell clang against Pete's front door, they turned toward Tommy without a smile between them. So this is a perspective from the actual townspeople, and it is such a succinct history of what's gone down. But it's just also such a fantastic summary of the disillusion of support for Tommy in the community. And I wondered if you remembered writing this and if you have any thoughts about it at all. I mean, it's just one paragraph within a wonderful book, but it just really stood out to me.
I have a very strange relationship with Colorado Springs. I grew up on the very eastern, southeastern edge of it. And it's a town that I could never embrace and felt like it could never embrace me. It was the kind of place, it was a very military town. Colorado Springs has got a lot of military installations, Fort Carson, Peterson Air Force Base, the Air Force Academy, NORAD. It's a very military town, and for an artsy kid, it was a strange place to grow up. It was the kind of place where people asked me what I would become when I was older. I'd say, I'm going to be a writer, and they'd just say, ha, no, really, what are you going to do? So it was a strange place, and I think that some of my feelings about that place are coming out in that paragraph. I think when I was in the early end of my time there, I was just a kid who, you know, maybe would straighten out and maybe wouldn't. But by the time I was done, I definitely felt like I had to move on, and I don't think anybody was really sad to see me go. It wasn't a place where I blended in. And I think a little bit of that is kind of autobiographical stuff coming out, which naturally happens in fiction. I mean, we can't create characters that are not ourselves. We're kind of limited to creating characters who are in some way, they're going to be imbued with our own spirit. And I think that's the autobiographical part of my life that kind of intersects with Tommy's right there.
Yeah. Okay. That comes through. I can totally see that. I wonder if you can talk, Stephen, about writing about people in a small town setting.
Writing about other people in a small town setting to me is about the same as writing about Tommy in a small town setting. Trying to realize what the scope of what they see is and what their stimuli are. In a small town like that, your stimuli is mostly the other people who are there and the landscape around you. So to me, that the small town, the tiny town, almost like a village, it's defined by its isolation, and most of the people in it are in isolation. The other thing is that they really know each other. Everybody knows everybody, what their habits are, kind of what their schedules are, because there aren't that many things to distract them from each other. This is sort of maybe perverse when you think about the small town values that are often trumpeted in America. It's like, oh, we really care about each other and we have this special bond with each other because we all live in this small town together. But I think the way small towns are is equally determined simply by the fact that there's just not that much other stimulus and everyone is living close and connected just by happenstance.
Yeah.
So writing the small town, writing Suborney in particular, is it was based on a couple of things, little towns, small villages that would be outside of Colorado Springs, that would be a little east of there. And also later on when I moved to northern Colorado, there were little towns along Interstate 76 or slightly off the highway that were kind of old and forgotten that I used to go and tour, just look around in. There's one city in particular that I'm thinking of that was used as a model for Suborney. There's actually one church, a little place called Log Lane Village, I think is the name of the town. But these little towns, especially if they're not thriving, they have a hopelessness to them that is really sad and poignant, and also something that I feel like I can work with as an author. I can go into these places and I can just kind of look at the inner lives of the people who are in them, and it's just a wonderful canvas to work with, because you just kind of scrape away and there are these scenes of life underneath. So that I like that about small towns, and I see a lot of small towns as a Great Plains person. I see a lot of just farmland, and then boom, there's a little town that might not even seem to have a name, or it doesn't even have a sign. So I spent a lot of time moving through and around places like that. So I have a fascination for them.
Another thing I think you do really well, which I think is probably necessary when you're writing about sort of any community with, you know, with characters that need to be brought out but not necessarily given a full life story, you are really good at offering suggestions of personality in physical description. So, for example, you have this one sentence: the tight corners of her mouth said she'd spent a long time holding back what she wanted to say. I thought that was just great, and I feel like in creating characters that we can feel like we have a sense of without necessarily having to give them 10 pages each, that's a really wonderful skill as a writer.
That's something that takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
And, you know, just figuring out, how am I going to do this? How am I going to give you the person in one glance, the way you would meet that person in reality? What is the telling detail that you're going to pull in? I think for me, part of that comes from screenwriting. My original training is screenwriting. I got an MFA from Florida State and spent a little unsuccessful time in LA, and have since been teaching screenwriting, I don't know, for the past 20-some years. And I'm always trying to tell people, look for the telling detail. What is that one detail, that thing you're going to notice? So one of the great things about teaching is that you remind yourself of your mantras a lot. And so as I go back and rewrite things, I'm looking to find that telling detail myself and just isolate it. And maybe that means cutting away a whole page of description down to a line. Mm-hmm. So we get the clearer impression, and just finding that detail. It takes time, and it takes the desire to want to cut, not simply for the sake of cutting, but to cut in order to show what is strongest in greatest relief.
Okay, that's a great way of describing it. Stephen, you describe yourself as a multi-genre writer. You have published a poetry collection, a story collection, this novel, and also an interactive digital memoir called Daddy Labyrinth. What's an interactive digital memoir? I'm like imagining you taking all your readers out for coffee.
Daddy Labyrinth is the first digital project that I did. And it's related to the earlier question that you asked about fathers and fatherlessness. I've always wanted to write about my dad and never really found a linear way to do that. But I found a software program out of the University of Southern California, which was then in beta 2012 or so, called Scalar. And what it allowed me to do was to just build essentially a hyperlinked set of texts, so that I could link one thing to another, and I could send people on wild goose chases through what was essentially a narrative environment as opposed to a narrative line. So imagine Daddy Labyrinth as 350 or so web pages, some of which have little offshoots of their own that are all connected with each other, that it's almost impossible to go through the same way twice.
Okay.
It's, you know, it's got a lot of videos, it's got some poems I wrote, it's got some poems that he wrote, it's got historical reflections, it's got all sorts of different things mashed up together. And this was a really fun thing to write. I love interactivity. I did another couple of projects, did an interactive film that was based off of that, called Talk With Your Hands Like an Ellis Island Mutt. And I got to go, it was a wonderful experience. I got to go to Norway and Singapore and Hong Kong and England and exhibit my work, which was really wonderful. Then I wrote an interactive romance novel called Love at Elevation, which is available from Choice of Games. And at that point, I realized that I just did not have the ability to look at code all day. And I kind of burned out. I kind of hit my own personal ceiling in terms of my interaction with technology, and realized that I wasn't able to make the kinds of things that I wanted to make, because I just didn't have the skills or the stamina that's required to go in there and really work with code. So that's when I went back into fiction. So I took kind of a break from fiction almost entirely from about 2011 to 2016 or so, when I picked up A Fathers in Fire and scrubbed it up and sent it off. And it was a wonderful time, but it had its limits. And now that I've tasted the novel, all I really want to do is write novels. But I've always been that kind of person who likes to wander. It's fun. I don't get bored as a writer. I don't get writer's block, because if I feel like I'm not making progress on a particular project, well, there is another type of project entirely that allows me to feel like, wow, I've got that youthful enthusiasm again. I'm just going to throw myself into it. It's really fun. Right now I'm working on a horror novel.
Oh, wow. I've
never done that before. So I think I've still maintained my genre hopping spirit, but maybe the form has kind of decided to settle down into the novel. We'll see.
That's interesting. Now, sometimes I'll see calls for submissions that encourage like audio files along with your prose or photographs or artwork. And so I'm never quite sure, and actually I should be able to figure this out because I do audio stuff all the time for the show, but like, you know, do you submit to those kinds of things? Do you send in audio files with other things? And do you think new writers should try that stuff, or do you feel like that's for just avant-garde? I don't know.
I'm not really sending out much right now. So I'm kind of out of the submissions loop. I'm sort of an opportunistic submitter. If something comes up and it looks like, wow, this is for me, then I'll send it in, but I'm not systematic at all anymore. Like I was 10 years ago. I think that writers should do and submit whatever it is they feel like submitting. I don't think that much gets accomplished because you think that there's a market for it. I think that, you know, there's got to be a market for it, but there's also got to be your desire to make it part of who you are. So if people feel like they want to do audio files, they should do audio files. It's certainly, obviously, you're part of the podcast revolution, so you know there's so much happening in audio right now. And we're going back in some ways to the days of the radio play.
Yeah, which is really fun. I mean, I just love it.
All these media are fantastic. And, you know, sometimes I have arguments with people, often English professor types, who they don't believe in new media. They're like, no. Games cannot be art. Games are games, and literature is literature. And I'm thinking, wow, that's not how I feel at all. There's so much wonderful work being done in new media that we didn't even have 10 years ago. And I liken where we are now to where cinema was between its invention in 1895 or so and around 1914-15, when D.W. Griffith first really settled onto the kind of editing style that we have and that we still hold a century later. There was this wild period between the beginning of cinema and the settling into a cinematic language, the good 20 years of people just doing all sorts of stuff. And if you look at those old films, we don't have cinema downright. And in a way, right now, what we've got with new media is that kind of phenomenon. People are just doing all sorts of things, and some of them are going to be imitated. And that's going to be how the form of new media is shaped. I look at what's happening with VR, for instance, particularly, you know, artificial intelligence informed narratives, which are kind of amazing. There's so much going on; it's all beyond my technical skill level. So at this point, I kind of, you know, let that go by, and I just watch it admiringly.
Yeah, the thing that I find though, and in a way it's both a positive and a negative, is that there's so much technology available now that so much work is being created, and it's hard to find it, and it's hard to be found, right?
Yeah, and it's hard to be kept. A couple of people I know are working very strongly in archival preservation of digital works. In the 1990s, the early days of the web, Some works that were really seminal were created, works that everybody's talked about and that show up in the textbooks now, 20 years later, but you can't play them unless you're on the right kind of machine, and a modern machine won't take them. So there are a few outfits that are simply stockpiling old machines, never updating the software, so that these old works can be played. And even the Library of Congress has gotten involved in creating repositories for a digital work like that. So you can tell I still get excited when I talk about the digital. It's I wish I could clone myself and one of them would just go off and just do that, but only one person, unfortunately.
When having conversations about it isn't like the same thing as looking at code all day, so.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's see. I want to get back to a couple questions about the novel. First of all, I just want to read a little couple lines, if it's okay with you. At this point, Tommy has gone on a bit of a journey. I don't want to spoil anything, so I'm going to leave it there. But he had played on street corners and parks in Norcator and Oberlin and Atwood and McDonald, blowing full tilt, that's on his saxophone, and showing people a kind of music they never knew existed. Angelic choruses, like Tessie sang, followed by scolds and yowls that sounded like the cries of some extinct animal dragged reluctantly back into life. There are so many examples in the book, but that was one of them that really stood out, of a really good job of describing music, which I think is hard to do. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about writing to represent music on the page.
Music was the first thing I wanted to do. I wanted to be a sax player when I was a kid. And then when my dad died, I kind of moved away from it because it was something that I think that I was doing because he liked it. So the sax has this kind of legendary stature in my own mind and imagination. It's kind of back to the good old days in a way when I still had a dad. And it's the first kind of artist I wanted to be, the first artist that I imagined myself becoming, and that also flows over into Tommy. So for me, being a writer is the second thing I wanted to be as an artist. As opposed to, you know, the first one being a musician. The other thing going on is that I, maybe because of that history personally, a very strong sense that musicality and language are incredibly intertwined. And I want people to be having a musical experience when they're reading my work, because the music is there underneath. And the musicality of a line or a sentence is incredibly important to the way we receive the sentence. I don't think that we simply receive literary material on an intellectual level. It would be sad if we did. We get it on the musical level as well, on the sensory level. It's hopefully a good piece of writing has got a fullness to it, to go back to a word you used earlier. That's really hitting all the senses, and the musical sense is one of them.
Yeah, okay, great. So you're saying like all of the prose is hopefully musical in nature.
Some of it's more musical than others, and I think when I invoke the saxophone is when it gets most musical. But for me, when I am revising, when I take out the red pen and look at the words on the page and say, nope, not that one, this one, I'm having a very musical experience. I am looking for rhythms. I'm looking for sounds. I'm looking for patterns. That's kind of what the writing process becomes for me. I'm a big reader aloud toward the end of the process. Mm-hmm. Really, those final drafts are all read aloud. That's where the musicality, maybe I'm exercising my inner musician when I get to that last phase of the writing.
Okay, great. I wanted to ask you if you've read anything lately that you might recommend to listeners.
I just read Chip Cheek's Cape May, which just came out. I am a associate editor at Fiction Writers Review, so I get a lot of books that come across slightly before they come out. And that's one of them. I'm looking at my pile right now. I've been reading Andrew Michael Hurley, Devil's Day and The Loney. He's a British writer, kind of gothic horror writer. And also, again, I'm on this horror kick. Gemma Files, who's a Canadian writer, she's written a book called Experimental Cinema. Right now, we talked about audio a little bit. I've really been into audiobooks, and I mostly listen to horror. And I think that's why I started writing a horror novel, because I used to be afraid. I mean, I never liked horror because I had enough kind of trauma in my own youth. I didn't want to, you know, go to the evil things. But, you know, like most of our hidden interests, they come to the surface. So I started listening to horror novels and really, really got into them. So you'll often find me listening to a horror novel while working out or just chilling out, because reading, sitting down and reading a book is harder than it used to be now that I'm teaching. And anybody who's interested in a teaching career should know that, you know, if you're reading a lot of student work, that writing or reading for pleasure, it's going to be harder to come by. And I was fortunately warned about this before I started teaching. And that's why I started doing reviews and interviews, so I could force myself to read new literature. But my reading life is definitely not what it used to be. I don't devour things as much as I used to. So I look forward to, at some point in my life, going back and reading all these books. I mean, even books by friends. I have so many literary friends now that I can't even keep up with all their books, let alone books by people that I don't know. So I loved being, you know, a college student and a post-college student, where I would just settle down with a book and just not do anything for a weekend. But those days are just gone, at least for now. You know, I've got to take the kids to soccer practice. They're referees. I've got all sorts of life happening. And boy, I miss those days of just like sitting underneath a tree and cracking open a book and going away for hours.
I like to end these interviews asking for you to offer advice for listeners who are writers. And in the case of your book, the narrative point of view of the book tends to mostly be Tommy's, and we come back to it quite a bit, but then you dip out into other points of view from time to time, like his mom's point of view. It's all, I think, third person close. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit about deciding who your narrator will be and whether to stay in one person's point of reference or to kind of expand that outward.
To me, the biggest question is, who is able to reveal the most emotional truth about the story? And that's the person who you should be making your narrator. If one person doesn't get what's going on or doesn't have insight into what's going on in an environment or in a human interaction, then that's not the right narrator. That narrator either needs to become another person or become the original person you're working with, but with more knowledge, with more understanding, with more willingness to tell the truth. When I teach about narrators, I like to use the metaphor of security clearance. Like in the government, you have people who have different levels of security clearance. And the person who has the most minute security clearance is not able to tell you that much about what's happening in the situation. The person who has more security clearance is going to be able to tell you a lot more, because that person might know the history of the town or the city you're writing about, might know all the people involved in the situation, and that person has a lot more access. So I'm always telling people, just, you know, get that security clearance down as low as you can, as deep as you can, so that you're working with a narrator who's telling the most truth. And also, you have to have a narrator who is willing to tell the truth. If the narrator doesn't want to say it, then it's not going to be said. So if you work with that person, that narrator, that foil, persona, whatever you want to call it, whether it's in third person or first person, it's still an entity that's separate from you as the author, and you create it in a very organic way. But having simply that dictum of trying to reveal the emotional truth of the scene by whatever means is necessary, that, I think, helps you toward creating a narrator who's going to be able to do that for you.
Okay, that's wonderful. That's a great answer. The name of the novel is Of Fathers and Fire. It's a novel by Stephen Wingate. It's published by the University of Nebraska Press. It's part of their Flyover Fiction series, which is a wonderful series edited by Ron Hansen. Stephen, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I've learned a lot, and I really enjoyed your book.
Thank you, Shelley. I really loved this. This was a lot of fun.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author Stephen Wingate. You can learn more about his work at stephenwingate.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Stephen Wingate. He calls it the endless sentence, and it is designed as both a loosening up exercise and a means of exploration. It requires only a timer and your favorite writing implement, analog or digital. You simply set your timer for 5 minutes and start writing, and everything is allowed except one single punctuation mark. The period. Stephen explains that writers rely on periods instinctively to separate thoughts from each other. If our thoughts feel like they're getting too uncontrolled or scraggly, as he says, we end one sentence and start another. But if you take that tool away from yourself, you're forced to keep flying through your thoughts with less control than you're used to. Stephen argues that this is a good thing because it means freedom, which is essential, especially early on in a project when you're looking for a narrator's or a character's voice. When you remove the period, you slip beneath your own radar and do things that surprise yourself. This can lead you to a new understanding of characters and settings, or maybe even to self-standing flash pieces with intriguing musical or formal features, for example, lists or recurring verbal motifs. Try this especially when you're feeling stuck or when a writing day hasn't gone according to plan. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And finally, if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.